You've just landed inside Launch Street, the innovation podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate and differentiate and get further faster in this crazy cluttered world. And now, innovation thought leader and your super fly host, Tamara Kleinberg.
Hey, Launch Street, Tamara here with a question for you. What's your innovation code? It could be the thing that ensures you are innovating in the right way and at the right time. Jeff DeGraff, author of the newly released book, Innovation Code, and innovation professor at the Ross School of Business, and founder of the Innovatarium Institute of Innovation, and co-creator of Competing Values Framework, came by. He hung out with me on Inside Launch Street to talk about the code, why conflict is important to innovation. And by the way, that's something I firmly believe in, but it's hard for people to do. It's why I was excited to talk to him about it. We also talked about how your greatest strength can also be your greatest weakness, which is a little bit of flip how we usually think about those things. All right, let's do it. Jeff, I am so looking forward to our conversation today. So thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Let's just dig right in. So here's what I want to know. Why is it that so many leaders give so much lip service to innovation, yet if you ask them for, as you say, their playbook or their plan, they tend to go blank. There's nothing to follow up with.
Well, there's a reason for that. And the first is a really important one. So I'm going to take a step back for just a minute. And that is, if you think about normal management is about standardization. It's about effectiveness, and it's about creating predictable outcomes. The first thing an organization tries to do is maintain its equilibrium. But the truth is, innovation is a form of deviance. It's a form of being different. And the more deviant the innovation is, the more likely it is to be valuable or breakthrough. So here's the problem. Almost all of the operating rhythm is designed to eliminate deviance. And it's even worse than that. And that is what leaders typically do is they put a process on top of innovation. And these processes are designed not to create variation, to eliminate variation. So the very tools that they even use to create innovation actually destroy it. They're not thinking about innovation the right way.
So can you give me an example of some of those tools? Because I totally hear what you're saying with our clients where they're like, well, this is how we do innovation, yet nothing's coming out of it. So when you go into a company, what are some of those things they're doing, thinking this is my innovation process, but it's actually sabotaging efforts?
Well, a couple of them, and it's going to be very controversial, I think, to a lot of your listeners. One, people love to run these things called stage gating systems.
Or stage gating systems.
And they're usually very long. It's like like recovering alcoholics. It's like a 12-step process, right? And the object of these is at every given step, to basically take all the to de-risk. It's what's called de-risking and pacing. And they originally developed in the 1950s by Procter & Gamble and companies like that that really were trying to manage, you know, 300 different products and 72 different markets. And so the object of it was to make innovation just a little bit better than the existing product that they've got. So think about it. What it's doing is it's slowing things down and it's taking any of the risk that's out of, that's in that innovation basically out of the innovation itself. Think about portfolio management. Portfolio management looks at when it compares apples to apples, what it basically does is looks at technical risk and relative rates of return. And who wins in that game are things that are relatively predictive, meaning they're extensions of today. So what they're doing is they're running tools that are going to take all of that innovation premium out of the equation.
So let me ask you this, because you had said earlier, you know, maintaining equilibrium versus being deviant, and that's where innovation is. And I love that kind of concept. And I almost in my head saw a teeter-totter where equilibrium was on one side and deviance was on the other. How do you balance those two? Because on one hand, right, a company needs to run smoothly and take out errors and mistakes. Yet on the other hand, and I 100% agree with you, they need to innovate. So how do you find, and maybe it's not balance, maybe it's just how do you fit those two together?
Well, I'll talk about how we do that, but I want to start with one size doesn't fit all in innovation. It's highly situational. One of the things that I'd love your listeners to consider, I've been looking at the list of the top innovative companies, right? These big lists since 1993. And here's a simple question for you. Why is it that less than 10% of the companies are on all the list? And the answer is simple. They're either not talking about the same thing or it's highly situational. So the whole checklisty thing is a terrible idea with innovation. How you make a fine dining restaurant and build a, you know, build a military grade aircraft is completely different, right? So here's the challenge. If you think about a teeter-totter, I love your vision. On one end of the teeter-totter is optimization. And optimization happens when things get mature, when they get large. And on the other hand, I want you to see innovation pushing up. And that's when things are fragmented and they're nascent. They're not clear yet. What an organization needs to do is it needs to put innovation on the first part of the teeter-totter and optimization at the back. It's a cycle. And this is what the great economist, the famous innovation economist, Joseph Schumpeter, called the sigmoid S. And what he meant was, and what people get wrong, is you're radical at the beginning and optimized at the end. So there's a place and a time to do these things. It's not that you do both everywhere. So I get into corporations all the time. You know, most of my clients are Fortune 500 clients. I've been in almost half of them at this point in my career. And what's interesting, you go to the C-suite, you talk to the senior leaders, and what they'll inevitably say is they'll say, what we really, really want in the organization is we want radical innovation. And you'll say, great, because it's time for that innovation to rejuvenate itself, right? And then you'll say, how are we going to do that? And what they'll do is they'll trot out every type of institutional process that they know, and every person on the Capitol Committee and every metric that they've got for introducing variants are designed to eliminate it. Now, one of the things your listeners should know in this area of innovation economics, we've had 6 Nobel Prize winners in this area. My favorite is Ned Phelps, Edmund Phelps, who won it in 06. And what they basically say is radical. They say that companies are not killed by competitors. They're killed because their dominant logic, their dominant way of doing things, what you're talking about, the optimization, becomes so strong at the very moment that they need to reinvent themselves, they can't.
So really, if I hear you right, Jeff, this is so interesting, they kill themselves.
Yes. Yeah. And if that's exactly what these 6 Nobel Prize winners have said.
So here's my question about the radical, because I hear this all the time, and I'm sure you do too. So, you know, radical, 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 that's the leadership talking. And then the team gets all inspired and they go discover and they, you know, come up with some radical ideas, and then they get squelched. So even if they do have the opportunity to come up with them, it tends to die a certain death because leadership then doesn't want to buy into it. And I don't mean to throw leadership under the bus. There's a lot of layers to all of it, I think. It's not just, you know, the C-suite or anything like that. How do you combat that when you, on one hand, you know, you've got the mandate of we have to reinvent, and then when that reinvention is even possible, it gets killed?
I think I actually am going to turn your observation upside down on you, if you will allow me for
sure.
A minute. I actually think all organizations have a part where they diversify or they hedge, like a venture capitalist does at the very beginning. And the reason is there's very little risk. You're mitigating risk. Little money, little time, you know, sprints, everything that people are writing about now, right? Which we've been doing this since the Second World War, right? It's an old idea. The problem isn't failure. The problem is success. So you run that little trial for that stent that you're going to put in somebody's body, and it turns out that it actually really works, and the drug that you put on it, the drug-eluted stent that you've got, is actually something that has miraculous properties. And now you come back to the board and say, this worked. I need $800 million to build the damn thing. And then they balk. And the issue isn't failure. The issue is believing what you're actually getting back from the market, believing the proof of concept, believing the road test. So what I see in reality isn't that they get squashed when they try interesting things. They get squashed in that teeter-totter you're talking about when it goes from the innovation end to the optimization end. And the reason is simple. The people who control the optimization end control the P&L, and the P&L is controlled by guidance, which you make to your investors, whether you're private or you're on Wall Street, and those people want predictability. And that's part of the reason in a lot of innovation research, there's a real question about scalability of the radical.
So how do you get over that? Because that's a pretty big brick wall. Because really, what in many ways, what you're saying is you've got to do your internal processes different as well to get to those external innovations. So, and maybe this is where we dig into the innovation code. So tell me if this is the place. But that, right, we got to bust down that brick wall for people. But that's change. So how do we do that?
I'm going to give you a simple rule. You know how they say the 80-20 rule? That's a great rule. It's a terrible rule.
Yeah.
It's the death of innovation. Innovation rule is the 20-80 rule. And I want your listeners to imagine a bell curve. And I want you to ask yourself, when do people really change? Do they change when their lives are normal, or do they change when their life sucks?
Yeah, when they have to. You know,
think about Apple in 97. I've been an advisor over the years to Apple. Think about what went on in 97. They're almost bankrupt. They're trading below $3 a share. When you're almost dead, the risk of trying something radical and the reward of staying where you're at is reversed. Just like if you're a person, you go through a divorce or you go through bankruptcy, the same thing. And it also happens at the other end of the bell curve when you're on a roll. You know, in 97, John Chambers' company, Cisco, was worth more than General Electric, right? So you're throwing sevens every time. Now, here's the point your listeners need to get. Innovation doesn't happen from the inside out. It happens from the outside in. What it means is in those tails where risk and reward is reversed, innovation migrates back to the middle. And this is what people get wrong. So a lot of the dynamics about how innovation works, people get wrong, right? They think innovation's about alignment. It's not about alignment. It's about conflict. You know, they think that innovation is about seeing the future first. You can't see the future first. You have to go into discovery mode. So a lot of the mechanisms we teach in business schools and we learn in managing a company are actually not only not true for innovation, they're actually the opposite.
So in your book, The Innovation Code, and again, this is one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you, because I couldn't agree more about conflict. You talk about how innovation happens when we bring people with contrasting perspectives and complementary areas of expertise together in one room. So talk more about why conflict, contrast is actually so important to innovation.
Yeah, I want you to think about for a minute about a company you've been in that seems very calm. I worked on a very famous project. I can't get into it here, but a very famous beverage. And I went to one of the world's largest beverage providers, creators. And they had beautiful Turner paintings on the wall and Muzak playing in the elevators. And everyone was calm. And what occurs to me in these places is the death of innovation is not conflict. It's apathy. It's everybody saying, oh, this is harmony. This is beautiful. When you see the 30 places on the planet that produce most of the GDP, most of the intellectual property, and whether you're reading Eric Weiner's book, you're reading Adam Grant's book or my books or whatever, what you're going to find in all these places is diversity. And the reason diversity is so important is that people don't believe the same crap. They believe different stuff. And what happens when people don't agree? Now, this is not amateur hour. This is important for your millennials to hear this. It's not a democratic process. Everybody's voice doesn't count the same. It's a meritocracy, right? It's that you have domain experts, deep domain experts, who don't agree, right? And when they don't agree, you're not arguing, or the conflict is not about personalities. The conflict is about ideas. And the key is, if you've got an organization that's aligned, you get compromise. Everybody tries to integrate the ideas, and what you get is vanilla ice cream. Right?
Yep.
If you've got ideas that are different, it makes a third idea, a hybrid idea. So I love going to places like Tel Aviv or in my little, I live in Ann Arbor, which has more venture capital per person than any city in the United States right now. In these places, you're going to see a lot of people with different ideas. And if you said today the sky is blue, someone's going to say it's not, and it's not going to be an opinion. You're going to have to form a different way of doing things. And it produces generative energy. And now here's a question for you. When you go into places, can you feel the energy of some of these organizations? Can you feel them hum?
Well, you can always feel them. And I think you can really tell the difference between the ones that are harmonious, as you say, and the ones that I would say are energetic, where people are debating. And it's actually funny. I was born in Israel, so maybe that's why I'm so okay with conflict. So I'm Israeli too, but we tend to be lovers of conflict, actually.
And it's one of the hotbeds for innovation. Yeah. And you're being funny about it. I actually think that's part of the reason it works.
It is. There's actually a whole book was written on that, on why Israel's so innovative. Yes. That was one of them. But you know, you said something somewhat quickly that I want to pause for listeners and just say, this is so important that good conflict or smart conflict isn't about personalities, it's about ideas. And I think that's actually a big point you just brought up, that I'm not debating you, Jeff, I'm debating that idea. And that's a much stronger, healthier place to bring conflict versus, you know, conflict, which is about personality, which nobody likes and everybody walks away pissed off.
Tamara, can you imagine if the whole healthcare debate was restructured in a different way? There are the people who want to have liberty or the choice, and people who want to have equality, which is that everybody has equality here. But imagine all that anger and all the money, you know, $500 trillion. Imagine that was harnessed in a productive way. Imagine that we were trying to move from that 17% of GDP to something that cut it in half and everybody had health care. Imagine what would happen with therapies and with the technology be integrated. The notion is it would be enormous. It'd be a moon launch. But it's not. What you've got are two groups trying to destroy each other, and it's the opposite of constructive conflict. And my view, for whatever it's worth, is that part of the American ethos and part of our success has been our ability to translate this conflict into innovation.
I mean, stop. You're making me all fluttery about the idea of the healthcare conversation changing in this country. It would be amazing. We're not there yet, but I really hope we get there soon. And you know, to dig more into that and into conflict, so what is, give me an example of what is great conflict. And I just want to share a story with you, Jeff, because I think you'll appreciate it. And maybe this is the same beverage company that we're talking about here. I used to work with a global beverage company. And one of the things that used to pain me was they were taught a framework for language that minimized conflict. And so they would have to say things like, so if I was presenting an idea, we'd be in these ideation sessions. Well, so they'd say, I have a clarifying question. I have a summary question, as if to not offend the person on the other side and minimize the conflict. And it used to drive me bonkers, and I think it really hurt the conversation. I mean, first of all, it's like saying, I don't mean to be rude, but like, I know you're going to be rude, so just do it. But also, it was a softener that actually, I thought, killed the conversation.
I couldn't agree more. And that's the problem with trigger words and safe spaces. The
safe
issue
spaces,
is
right?
You don't have to agree with people. Right. You don't have to say that I agree with that idea. In fact, people, we had an issue in the news yesterday with Google. Somebody said something that's probably a pretty bad idea, and it's something that certainly I wouldn't support. But the notion is that somebody said something and their immediate response was, well, I don't agree with it. So, and you know where this comes from? This comes from social media, where if somebody doesn't believe all the same crap you believe, you unfriend them. Oh my God, the Spanish Inquisition couldn't have thought of that. And so what you get are microsegments. People have no line of sight to the opposition, and what they develop is monological thinking. And then you wonder why we have this problem. Well, we have this problem because there's no places where the rivers meet.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, when I travel, and you travel a lot too, so I don't know if you do this, I listen to NPR on a regular basis, but when I travel, because then I have cable, I don't have it at home, I actually watch CNN, and then I also watch Fox News, because I want to see all the varying opinions, and see how they come together, and see how they're different, and I think that actually, it's so helpful when we can broaden our perspective as well, to your point, not have these microcosms of everybody that agrees with us. So, and on that, I want to ask you a question, because we were talking offline about, and I made a joke about yes butters and how we tend to avoid them.
Yep.
But I think we can actually harness them. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think one of the biggest things is, if you're engaged in a conflict, you need to move the conflict away from the personality, and you need to start generating some ideas in a way that people don't feel threatened. And remember, when we're creative, it's a pretty intimate moment. And if people don't like your ideas, we often feel pretty rejected.
Yeah, it hurts.
By it, right?
It's like you called my baby ugly.
Yes. So the object isn't to make people mean. The object is to help people see their blind spots. The object is to say there are some blind spots here. Now I want to caution your listeners for one thing. That doesn't mean that your opinion is the same as accurate information, right? So one of the things I find, or somebody say, well, my opinion is this and my opinion is that. That's not the same as I'm trying to create constructive conflict. Constructive conflict is you have a belief, you've got an idea about something, and I say, yeah, that's true, but have you thought about this, right? That's true, but what would happen if this happened? Right? How you account for this issue, and what those kind of questions do is they make you look in the places you don't want to look in. And when you start doing that, you've taken people out of a reactive position. Now, this is very important about conflict. If you've ever had a good idea, anybody who's listening has ever had a good idea and they presented it to somebody, they're going to tell you immediately what's wrong with it.
Yeah.
And here's an old professor's trick. Say, you know what? That's right. What would you do? And the minute you ask that question, it turns them out of a reactive position. Think about the healthcare debate. Oh, it's the worst thing ever. The Affordable Care Act was the worst thing ever. They had 8 years to plan for this. And then when it came time for the loyal opposition to say what their ideas were, they had no ideas. They were taken out of a reactive position, and they were not prepared in the because they were in a reactive position. They were against something. When it becomes, what are you for? Now, all of a sudden, where's everybody at? We're going to have to work together and come up with a hybrid. Yeah, right? That probably should have happened a long time ago. And that's what I'm getting at. We've got to stop avoiding the conflict. We have to engage it like adults, respectfully.
Yeah. So how do you do that? So let's say I'm a leader in an organization. I've got a team, and I want to move the next meeting I have, the next time we're going to create together. How do I do that? How do I move them when the pattern has been either, you know, softening the blow in safe spaces, or just everybody yesing everybody?
You partner people with their opposite. In the book, I go into these four archetypes. And what's very different from my work is my work is not like a Myers-Briggs test or a brain dominance test. My work is based on trying to predict share prices. So it starts out by saying I look at value propositions. And my if anybody's followed any of my work, that's about – because that's what people innovate. Why the big companies call me is they're trying to move the share price. Then you work backwards to saying culture and competency is the one thing that – that actually gives us a line of sight to predicting it. And the reason is simple. There's no data on the future. So because the actual outcome we can't predict, we have to look at the causes of the outcome. And it's a little more sophisticated than that, but I want to make this simple. What the problem becomes is leaders create culture and competency that looks like them, right? The good people are the people like me, right? So what you want to do is this is not an issue of style. This is very important to hear this because think about this for a minute. Somebody who's a manufacturing operating officer is trying to create quality and efficiency. And quality and efficiency, Tamara, are created by the reduction of errors, by the reduction of deviance. Now take your marketing officer or your innovation officer who's trying to introduce radical deviance to make a breakthrough miracle drug or something that flies for 50 years or speculate a new market. The fact that they have differences are not differences of style. One person is trying to destroy the value proposition of the other. And this is the key to the whole book, that there are issues of magnitude, how much innovation, and issues of speed, how fast the innovation has to work, that are tensions. These are tensions that happen individually, they happen in teams, they happen organizationally, they happen strategically, how companies compete. So the key is if I'm in that meeting, I put two people together who are at the opposite ends of this. And what I ask them for are hybrids. I need a solution that I can actually have a breakthrough product or service or solution, and I can scale the damn thing. That's what I'm trying to do together. If I'm going to avoid that in the group, if I'm going to avoid conflict in the group, I can't give you any panacea for innovation because you're not going to get it.
So let's dig a little bit into those four innovation approaches or personalities, as you say. Will you give us an overview of what they are and how to think about them? Because I want to know who to put in the room together.
Yeah. So the first thing to think about is you want to think about pairs. So I'd like you to think about Lennon and McCartney for a minute. Get a picture of those guys in your mind. You're probably not old enough to remember them. John Lennon was kind of this really artsy-fartsy guy, and he was always into speculating about stuff. And, you know, if you ever listen to the song Across the Universe, you know, a lot of these were kind of written in altered states. So I want you to think about this person who's highly creative and kind of discovery-based, and I want you to think of a person who's constantly – you know, in love with new ideas. They hang out with weird people. They're speculating about, you know, the way the world works. They're very freedom based. They hang out. There's like a Fellini movie around them. You know, all the weirdos are around them, and they're very self-authorizing, which means they have their own way of doing things. Because they're created, they're being driven by their vision, just like Steve Jobs was, and just like Walt Disney was. They see things. I want you to imagine that person, and that's Lennon, and I want you to imagine McCartney. Now, McCartney's this guy whose uncle was in the, you know, was a musician. He's a trained musician. He shows up at the studio at the same time. His whole worldview is about, you know, how we can incorporate the crumb horn into this thing. And he's got a milestone for everything. And there's a process that everybody has to go through. And, you know, people think he's a bit of a control freak. Well, Lennon is an artist. And McCartney is what we'd call an engineer. Now, of course, in the larger sense, they're both artistic. But what happens when the two of them come together is you get music that's quite different and unique. Think about Rubber Soul or Sgt. Pepper, any of those great albums. And then, but it's also articulated in a relatively brilliant way. It's implemented in a brilliant way. These are the first two types. Now, the first type, the Lennon type, he's going to be really good or she's going to be really good in a unique situation because they're very ad hoc. So if we're trying to create a miracle drug or it's fashion and we're trying to create haute couture and our organization is kind of fluid, it's like a Grateful Dead concert, right, moving around, or we're a startup that can't compete on scope or scale, we're going to see things like that. So this type succeeds in these situations with these types of organizations. But the McCartney type, the engineering type, They're going to do really well in situations that are predictable, like we're making cars or we're selling, you know, gas. Their organization is going to be very hierarchical, like the military or Dell Computer or McDonald's, where some illiterate kid presses a cheeseburger button and simultaneously somebody shoots a cow in Argentina and kind of everything in between happens, right? Now, the point I'm trying to make about these two things is that they succeed in environments or situations where they're optimized. But here's the key. The key is when you put these two kinds of people together or put them in the opposite situation, they have to adjust by developing a new way of doing things. So here's a second key learning for your listeners. Innovation is not born from freedom. It's born from constraints. It's born from trying to get around limits. And so what happens when you put Lennon and McCartney together, you get something that's very different or something very unique. This is the continuum of how much innovation do I want. Do I want radical stuff like Lennon, or do I want incremental and scalable stuff like McCartney? And the answer is you want both, right? And of course, the most famous example, I think, in business is one of our students here at Michigan, Larry Page, you know, and Serge. And those of us who have sort of been on this ride from the very beginning, you know, Larry's pretty green. He's pretty artistic, right? He's pretty out there. And Serge is pretty buttoned down. And don't get me wrong, they're both creative and they're both smart. But the notion is, if you really want to know what somebody is, look at what they do when they're under duress. Where do they go? Are they right-handed or left-handed? So the artist is visionary. They're held together by their vision. And the engineer is held together by process, and that's where they go. So that's the first pair. Now, did you have a question before I go to the second?
Yeah, I have one quick question for you. It sounds like, as you're talking about these, that there's a foundation that the conflict people with the conflict or the different personalities have in common. You know, they have a desire to create amazing music or art. They have a desire to create a brilliant technology product, whatever it is. I mean, it sounds like there's a common thread there. And then on top of that, right, you add the layer of this complementary or this conflict, and that's what helps take that vision and make it really possible.
That's exactly right. There has to be a sense. There has to be a sense of destiny. There has to be a sense of there, right? And that's part of the reason for teaching people to think around these four worldviews. Because if you don't understand the other worldview, you don't know where there is. Mm. Talk to anybody at an airport about innovation, and they'll give you a different definition of what innovation is. And the reason that's a problem is if you don't have a shared idea of where there is, you can't get there. And you certainly can't get there together.
Right. So, okay, what are the other two?
Well, the other two are, if you think about what I call the athlete view. The athlete view is very good in competitive situations. And I spend a lot of time in these companies where there's, you know, you're aggressive, you're demanding, and they're contentious. Consumer electronics, you know, ball teams, you know, snack foods, where the other guy's trying to kill you, right? And these situations are typically market driven. So they're very fast. They're very profitability driven. And these kind of athletes, if you will, they're very sort of vital, and they're very much searching around their own sort of brand and prosperity. And when I think of this, I think of like a Ben and Jerry. You know, they're always thought of as these granola eaters. But the truth is, you know, they built this incredible company that they sold for, you know, $500 million to Unilever back in the day. Now, the opposite of the athlete, which are, incidentally, I'm a boomer. Boomers and athletes go together. We competed for everything. I teach at the Ross School of Business. I'm a professor here for almost 30 years. We grade on a curve. You're right. Can you imagine an innovation class graded on a curve? We work on real projects. Why? Because, you know, you don't let the weak set the pace. You're thinning the herd, right?
That was my college years too, so I'm with it. Yep.
The good news is we produce a lot of good people, so it's a great place to be. But the opposite of our kids, they're the sages. Mm. They're cooperative in situations where they share beliefs and values. You know, boomers are held together by goals, millennials by values. You know, we're not going to drive cars. We're going to live in small houses. We're going to have friends with benefits, right? This is a different group, you know, and their organizations are clannish. So they're very good at sharing and searching, replying, very community-based. And these sages are very interested in developing their capability, developing kind of the community around them. They're very harmonious. They're incredibly good at being sustainable. Right, because they're held together by values. But the boomers are very good at hitting things very, very quickly. So what you're seeing are the old mainline, you know, darlings of the S&P are these kind of market companies that are driven by athletes. But on the other hand, what you're starting to see are these millennial companies, Tom's Shoes, you know, we're saving the environment. That's a different kind of a company, and that's more sustainable. So that's the tension about how fast, how much, how fast, these two tensions.
One of the things that you mentioned in your book that really caught my attention was this whole thing about your dominant worldview is your strength and also your weakness. And I want to ask you about that because I think we sometimes fall into this trap of here's my strength in this bucket, and then over here is my weakness in this bucket. And they're not the same thing. They're kind of an either or. But what you really say is that they're two sides of the coin.
I am. And one of the things that's interesting is if you've ever talked to anybody, I've been married for a long time. I've been married forever. And it's very funny when you talk to newlyweds and you say, you know, because what they want to talk about is they'll talk about, you know, I've been married, I'm really happy. But you know what she does? You know what he does? And it's, somebody's been married a long time, you have to chuckle. And you go, good luck working that out. Because what everybody's been married for a long time knows is that's never going to change, ever. Because what you like about the person also brings something with it that you don't like. So let me give you an example. Artists, we all love Steve Jobs. And I actually was very lucky to be an advisor in the old days of what was called Applied Integrated Systems. I was an advisor to him in the old days. And what's interesting is, but when you read the books, the Walter Isaacson book, he talks about sort of his poor methodology and his unrealistic vision. Well, that's part of the downside of being a visionary leader.
Yeah.
Yet you're going, or you talk about, you know, Ray Kroc, who I got to, you know, when I'm one of the guys who built Domino's Pizza, I don't know if you know that. But when I was young and I got to go to McDonald's and meet Ray Kroc, the whole idea of right way and wrong way thinking to this guy who was this brilliant engineer was exasperating, right? This is the way you do it. This is not the way you do it. So the point is, all of us have this dominant worldview, and think of it like being right-handed or left-handed. And it also brings a blind spot and a downside. You're not going to get rid of it, right? What you have to learn, like being married for a long time, is how to live with it, how to incorporate it, how to not be offended by it.
So what do you do about it? And it's funny, as you're saying that, I've got the list of all my quirks, as I like to call them in my marriage,
yep,
that are probably my strength and my weakness all at the same time. So I get that I live with it, but beyond that, what really, how do I think about it? What do I do about it? How can I use that information to help me, you know, be more innovative?
Make people self-aware. So I'm married to an athlete. I'm an artist married to an athlete. She's very aggressive. She's super smart. I'm married to a Chinese woman who's, you know, from East Asia and 10 times smarter than I ever thought about being. And when she gets going on the sort of athlete thing, what I try and do is two things. I try and make her aware that she's in the negative zone of what she does. Like, well, you're stressed out because of this, this, and this. And, you know, never belittle somebody or try and change them. Just make them aware about that. And then the other thing is, in all of these quadrants, there are things you can do to walk people back. Saying, you know, I know you need to talk to this person who works for us. You know, we own these innovation labs around the world, right? I know you need to engage this person. But this person's really a sage, and I just need you to know that you're going to really hurt their feelings and kind of really destroy what you're trying to do if you're going to be that aggressive with it. You might want to step it back a little bit when you engage them. And some days, like everyone, we have good days and bad days. There's the days that she goes, you know, you're right. And there's the days that she shows me her teeth. I'm like, okay, you know, I got it. But I think that's part of being human. I mean, the whole idea that we're going to be perfect, I think, is a terrible idea, because perfection to an innovator is death. Innovators want to be new. They want to be better. Right. So the whole idea that we're trying to be perfect, I think, is just a terrible benchmark.
So do these different innovation code approaches, personalities, do they fit better at different stages of the innovation process?
They sure do. Yeah.
How does that work?
I didn't interrupt you. You're exactly right. They sure do. The people who are brilliant at the beginning of projects are artists, because they have a high tolerance for ambiguity and they normally diversify. Right. And it's a freak show. They hang out with people with different ideas, so they hedge. When the second part of this is a real difficult thing, and the reason is, artists, when they're left alone, become orphans. This is the problem with tech centers. And you go to any tech center and they'll say, we've got whammy zammy stuff. We don't know why the company acquired this small startup company. When I was just at one, you know, I'm on these advisory boards, these huge companies. I had one where they had two Nobel Prize winners. They had bought a company that these Nobel Prize winners were way in front of them. But the Nobel Prize winners liked to live in the same little place and didn't want to deal with anybody who wasn't really an artist. The second part of a project, you're going to have both the athlete and the sage. And the problem in the second part is these are oppositions. They're dogs and cats. One wants to do things quickly. One wants to be sustainable, right? But the other problem is the other challenge is it's the longest part of the project. So tomorrow the challenge is this is often where innovation projects lose their momentum. They lose hope. It's the gates of Harvard, you know, the Dante, you know, abandon hope, all you who enter here, right? And then the final stage, the final stage of a project is the engineer, when you have to optimize, you have to eliminate variation to get scale, right? This is where the stage gate system should be placed. And of course, the challenge there is they've got their whole life worked out. And the minute you introduce variation, they're going to try and reject it. So the problem isn't on projects, any one of the worldviews. The problem is the handoffs. So you want to get people in the right order, the artists first, you know, athletes and sages second, and finally, you want to put engineers at the end. And you want to have all four types represented at all times. So you have conflict, constructive conflict, but you want to listen to one more at each stage. So I know in my own work, my lab work, some of the stuff I've built, I'm a really good person to listen to at the beginning of a strategy. But by the time we're kind of at phase three of a strategy, you don't want to listen to me anymore. Then you should be listening to other people.
So one of the things I've come to see quite often, and I'd love your perspective on this, is that organizations often make what I would call a mistake of thinking that, you know, innovation only exists in the artist phase of the project or whatever it is, that's, you know, it's all blue skies, forest through the trees, shoot for the moon, la, la, la. And then they kind of suck the life out of the innovation moving forward. So it almost gets siloed to people with special shirts, you know, and special titles.
Huge problem.
Yeah, it's big.
You're absolutely right. And it's completely wrong. Think about it for a minute. Think about where is the innovation in Amazon? It's a supply chain distribution play. Where is the innovation in Starbucks? It's just theater. It's experience economy with a commodity we've had for 4,000 years, right? And everything in between. And what's amazing is that people don't get that even people in the same category don't innovate the same way. So think about Apple, which basically doesn't make anything except for design. You know, Foxconn and Invitech, everybody makes everything else. But what they have is a closed operating system. And they compete in markets against Google, which makes everything basically, what is it, 54, 55 companies now? And they have an open system. So even in the same categories, we're going to see, you know, Brazil versus Germany. We're going to see offenses and defenses in different ways. So the whole this is why this whole book is about mindset, because process and checklists are highly situationally specific. And the minute you do that, I can give you 1,000 examples of where they don't work. And that comes back to your original question. Why don't they run a playbook? Because if it was that easy to make a process, we'd all do it. But it's not. So what you have to have are groups of people who at least speak the same language and have a shared mindset about how the dynamics and structure of this work. And more importantly than that, rather than having everybody be an innovator, which would be a disaster, you want to have a few highly practiced people throughout the organization. And to your point, some of them should be in supply chain, in operations, and some of them should be in product development and marketing in the places we normally find them.
Well, I think we sometimes forget that the most meaningful innovation sometimes comes in how I click on that email and I get my product, not just what the product is itself.
And many times, more and more these days, you're right. More and more, that's the way it's going.
So what's one thing you want our listeners on Launch Street to take away to say, hey, if you do one thing today, aside from buy the book, and we'll get the link and all that up in a second, but what's the one thing that you would say, hey, I want you to think about this as you go forward?
I want you to think that innovation requires generative energy. Innovation is a form of energy. It's a manifestation. And I want you to think that energy is created when you want something that doesn't occur right now. And the only way you're going to get that energy is surrounding yourself with people who don't believe the same crap you believe, changing the voices in your own head that you actually listen to from yourself, from inside. You know, the voice that says, I should be like this. I'm a professional person. I'm successful. Well, there's another voice that wants to be something. And instead of being afraid of conflict, dive into it. because that's where the new idea is. That's where the momentum, the personal genesis is going to start.
I love that you just said dive into conflict. For all you launch readers out there, that is so powerful right there to think about the next time you're in a disagreement with somebody, instead of butting up or backing up, dive into it. One of my favorite things to do when someone says something that that I disagree with, and normally sometimes it puts me into fight or flight mode, just to be honest, you know, you're like, oh, wait, what? I need to argue with you. I take a deep breath and I just go, tell me more.
Yep.
And then it's fascinating what you learn.
Yes. And why that's so important. The whole process of being a leader, most of it is making sense of things. What does this mean? What does this mean? So why did these people do this? Or why are they buying this? And that becomes the thread, if you pull it, that will take you to the interesting insight. And it's not that you've invented anything new or you're brilliant. It's that you've seen something that no one else saw. You saw the incongruity and you dove into it. You followed it until it manifested as a solution or product or service or whatever it is you're into.
Well, I think what you're saying really reinforces what I think we're seeing a lot too with leadership and strong organizations is it's not about information, it's about insights. And we have enough information. We're so overwhelmed with data. We hear that all the time, but what does it all mean? How do you put the pieces together in a way that actually brings forward innovation?
Yeah, I was at a big meeting yesterday. I was telling you this in Denver with these very, very smart people at a think tank. And somebody asked me about what I thought the biggest innovation right now was. And I said, well, it's entirely social. Mm. And they said, what do you mean? And I said, I want to give you three statistics about young people under the age of 30, millennials. I said, number one, starting in 2014, over half of all live births to women under the age of 30 are outside of marriage. Marriage is no longer normative. Adjusted for socioeconomic status, the more educated the woman is, the less likely she is to marry. And people have these experiences.
Wow.
Number two, what kind of company do young people want to work for? And they all say Google, et cetera. And I showed them the Pew Charitable Trust research. He says, no, they want to work for themselves. They want to exhibit self-authorizing behavior. They want to take 2 months off and cure river blindness in Tanzania. They want a portfolio life. Very different. It's a post-capitalist generation.
You
and
know,
three,
oh, sorry,
and three their fastest growing religion to people under the age of 30 is atheism. Yeah. So here's a trend. Here's something that people have all seen, but they haven't seen. They haven't made sense of it. Our children have opted out of the institutions that my generation used to change the world. So the apparatus we use to change the world, hopefully for the better, they've completely opted out of. Now, if you think about that insight, there's a lot that changes a lot of things.
You know, I'm laughing a little bit only because, first of all, there's major banging in our office going on. So sorry about that. But I work at WeWork, one of the collaboration sites, which I love. I love the energy. I love the collaboration with people who have nothing to do with me. And I'm a Gen Xer. I'm the generation nobody talks about. And I love to sit out in the lobby because I'm hearing all these millennials on their phones and in their conversations talking about the businesses they're starting. And it's all social. There's something in it that's like, I'm going to cure blindness. I'm going to change,
yep.
You know, health. I'm going to reinvent healthcare. And I'm like, God, you guys are amazing. But
they
totally.
Are.
And, you know, I'll just give you a very quick story. And then we've got to wrap up, although I feel like we need to have you back because I don't think I got to question 6 through 10 on my list for you. So I've got two kids. They're 8 and 12. And we recently went on vacation in Telluride. And we don't have cable at home. And we were up there and they have cable. So they got to watch Cartoon Network for the first time in years. And they were so annoyed by the commercials. And I thought to myself, man, that's how I used to find out about new products. Like, that's incredible. You could care less. But that actually translated to purchase behavior. Then I took him to the store to get new shoes because school's starting. And my 8-year-old, I showed him these. It was actually Skechers shoes that light up on the bottom. And I looked at him and I said, Ari, do you want those shoes? Those are the ones. And he goes, no. Those are the ones from the commercial. And that just got in the way of my TV show. No. And I was like, oh my goodness. Like, look how the behavior and the generations are changing. And we have got to be smarter about keeping up with that.
But that's why your generation, and you're hearing it from a boomer, is going to be the most important generation because you speak both athlete and sage. You speak boomer and millennial. And even though you're the smallest generation, The truth is,
we're mighty.
You're an ambassador. You speak all the languages.
That's right. Well, you know, as I was reading your book, I vacillate between thinking I'm an artist and an athlete. Because on one hand, I'm very free flowing, open, like let's create. On the other hand, I get highly competitive. So I was trying to figure out like where I actually fit. But Jeff, this has been amazing. I wish we could continue on. But where can people go to learn more and connect with you?
Well, my website, jeffdegraff.com, right? It's just my spelling, D-E-G-R-A-F-F, and it'll take you to my innovation labs. And incidentally, if you buy the book, there's a free assessment that comes with it. So you can figure out what you are. And there's all the videos. I have a massive open online course at Michigan that's very popular. And you can do all that. Just go to jeffdegraff.com. The book is called The Innovation Code, The Creative Power of Constructive Conflict. And hopefully your listeners will engage in some of that positive tension, not the negative stuff. And maybe we can change the discussion and dialogue we're having in this country to something that's positive and productive.
It's fantastic. Last question for you is, what's one thing people would be surprised to learn about you? It can be hobby, passion, experience.
I used to be a studio guitar player and a songwriter and make records as part of a group, which I won't tell you what it was.
Why can't you tell us? I feel like you just dangled the carrot.
No, you'll look it up and then you'll figure out that I became a fuddy-duddy in my old age.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much. This has been incredible insights into kind of real innovation.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for hanging out with us inside Launch Street. When you're ready to take your game to the next level, join the thousands of others that are upping their innovation edge on GoToLaunchStreet.com, the top online education resource and community platform for innovators looking to use innovation to get measurable results. GoToLaunchStreet.com.